Okay. So I have no financial disclosures. As you all know, seasonal flu vaccine is now recommended for over 300 million adults and children in the U.S. each year, and community settings have become increasingly important venues for influenza vaccine delivery in the U.S. So we sought to describe barriers to and solutions for expanding influenza vaccination in community settings. And to do this, we conducted qualitative, semi-structured, one-hour telephone interviews from January 2009 through June 2010 with key stakeholders involved in flu vaccination in the U.S. So this included health insurance plans, state and local public health immunization programs, community vaccinators, of which we included medical services firms, which are entities like Vax America, retail-based clinics, pharmacies, and schools. We conducted 65 interviews, and there were two of us who conducted all of these interviews, with 26 health plans, 11 public health officials, and 28 community vaccinators. Coding was done iteratively using a grounded theory approach, and we had three investigators independently review transcripts and the coding scheme to validate our findings. So in the influenza vaccine delivery system in community settings, we found that there were three key areas that actually are universal to vaccination in terms of potential barriers to delivery. One is purchase and distribution, the second is delivery logistics, and the third is reimbursement. So focusing in on purchase and distribution, there were two key areas that were problematic. One was provider purchasing, and the second was a perceived inequity in distribution. So providers described that they purchased smaller volumes of vaccines due to the uncertain timing of vaccine availability, the uncertain nature of public demand, and the need to minimize unused vaccines, because it did carry a financial risk for providers. So one person stated, "We didn't finish getting all of our vaccines until early December in a particular year, which, given what we had told you about people caring about that by December, meant that we had vaccines left over." So these providers who then purchased in smaller volumes actually ended up paying a higher price per vaccine dose, making the operation more costly because they were purchasing in smaller volumes. In addition, some stakeholders had the perception that certain providers acquired vaccines earlier in the season than others. And regardless of whether or not that was true, this perceived inequity led to changes in their purchasing behavior. So people were concerned about declining public demand later in the season, which they felt would increase their risk for unused vaccines. And again, that led to smaller purchase volumes and potentially higher prices for those providers. Some of the key areas that people felt helped or facilitate the expansion of the purchase and distribution barriers, or overcome those barriers, was coordination within and across stakeholder groups as a facilitator. So this is a key theme. As an example, for the public health stakeholders, they felt that multi-state purchasing agreements reduced vaccine costs for them, and that was helpful. Community vaccinators cited that, and this is groups such as retail-based clinics or pharmacies, cited that they pooled purchasing across multiple sites in order to achieve discounts in pricing. And then once they achieved that discount, they could then redistribute the vaccine according to the sites accordingly. The third is that public health was seen, distribution as a barrier, public health could be seen as a facilitator in that they could serve as a trusted broker to ensure equitable access to vaccines by providers. So there was one person in particular that spoke of official start dates or establishing these official start dates to reduce competition among providers and to minimize uncertainty about demand. And it was felt that that helped level the playing field for that community. And then finally, public health was often seen as an information broker, so a central place where the community, as well as providers, community vaccinators, for example, could post their information and connect demand to supply. So next were some of the delivery barriers that we ran into, and I'm only highlighting two examples here. One was concerns about vaccinating young children, although these gentlemen were able to overcome that. And the second was off-site and school-based clinics. So in terms of concerns about vaccinating young kids, some health plans were reluctant to encourage vaccination in these age groups and community settings. Some of the health plans that were part of integrated delivery systems actually said that access was not a barrier for their patients. They felt like there was sufficient access and there was not necessarily a need to go outside of the healthcare system. But in addition, one of the more quotable findings was the lack of information or the ability to share that information if there was not a good and functional immunization registry in their state. So overall, the biggest problem of non-traditional providers is getting the info back to the providers. The flow of information is too delayed and spotty at best, and so for that reason, the health plans felt like it was a barrier to contract with community vaccinators. Community vaccinators also cited barriers. They said it was frustrating for them as well to not be able to easily share documentation with primary care providers, especially for young children. They felt the need to want to do that. From what we saw in the interviews that we had done, there was limited interest in providing VFC vaccines to children. Some of this was limited interest, and some of it was lack of awareness. But amongst the people who actually knew about the VFC program, there was concerns about the complexity of managing separate inventories, which many of you are used to doing, but for a community provider, it was not second nature. Especially when they were moving thousands of off-site clinics from site to site daily, they were worried about confusion. And then second was perceptions about limited profit margin. So in these off-site clinics, they felt that they were more costly and less profitable unless they were guaranteed an absolute minimum volume. And in addition, interestingly, some of the vaccines they stated were not always eligible for reimbursement. So even if they were a contracted provider, they were considered a contracted provider at a certain site. So if they picked up and delivered vaccine at a school, they wouldn't necessarily get reimbursed, even though they should have been reimbursed if they got vaccinated at their retail-based clinic or pharmacy, for example. School-based clinics, or the school nurses we spoke to, said that there was a reluctance by school administrators to host clinics during school hours, and that the limited resources that they had within their school to advertise, distribute, collect, and verify consent forms, and then to document vaccines given was a huge enough barrier, and that was even without having to deliver the vaccines, because they often partnered with public health to come in and deliver vaccines. So I'm just sharing three interesting examples regarding facilitators of vaccine delivery that show how collaboration can work. Slightly different, but somewhat overlapping. So in the first instance, we found that local or state public health could actually collaborate with these medical services firms. So for example, if a public health clinic decided to offer vaccine free of charge to all members of the community, whoever walked in, they could actually partner with these medical services firms and work side by side. So what they'd do is they'd screen the patient and say, are you VFC eligible or not, for example. And if you were, you went to the public health side. And if you had Medicare or insurance plan that paid, they shunted you over to the medical services firm side. That way, the medical services firm could seek reimbursement appropriately, and the public health folks could actually vaccinate the folks that weren't otherwise going to be eligible. So that was one type of partnership that worked. And actually, they also spoke to the fact that out of the 1,000 doses they had, they could make it stretch much, much further when they had this partnership up and running, and actually didn't really require much other than telling the medical service firms what time the clinics were. They could just show up. A second common model we heard about was where school nurses would work with local public health and community volunteers. So the school nurses would set up the site and advertise the clinic. The public health folks would come in and vaccinate kids. And then they actually enlisted the help of community volunteers to assist with paperwork and documentation as appropriate. And a third and actually really interesting model was also identified, where private providers, so private docs in their offices, collaborated with medical services firms to provide vaccines. So these medical services firms would actually go to a physician's office on specified dates and times and conduct a vaccination program for them. These MSFs, or the medical services firms, would essentially therefore take on the financial risk of these vaccines, and on top of it would bring the vaccine supply and then document everything and leave all the documentation right there in the office so that the primary care physician had it. Then in turn, the medical services firm charged a flat rate per vaccine given in the private provider's office. And the private provider could then bill the insurance companies where they had already had set up relationships with them and submit these claims for these patients. And it was great because then patients didn't actually have to pay out of pocket. There was no concern there. So the last area where we found some interesting barriers were, of course, in reimbursement. One was with regard to contracting, and the other was with regard to billing. So in terms of contracting and billing barriers, we found that community vaccinators were actually reluctant to contract with health plans unless they had a large market share or unless all enrollees were covered regardless of type. So Medicare is the best example of this, but actually there were some examples of private health insurance plans that would cover regardless of type, and they would actually enter into contracts with those insurers. Conversely, health plans were actually reluctant to contract with community vaccinators unless their market share was substantial. So one health plan stated, because we're a national plan, it's much easier for us to go with the national players or big regional players. Having the one that does it in a single city probably isn't going to be that helpful to us. It's much easier to manage a limited amount of contracts than 400 bazillion of them every season. For community vaccinators, another barrier was determining eligibility at the point of service. So if they didn't have a blanket approval to vaccinate all enrollees in that health plan, they actually then had to stop and find out if their particular plan would cover a vaccine or not. And they said that took longer than actually vaccinating them and asking them to pay cash. So that was a barrier. And then finally, for some public health and school nurses, although this is changing nowadays, there was a sense that the lack of trained billing staff in their departments was a barrier to being able to bill insurers for this. In terms of facilitators, health plans stated that they were willing to contract with community vaccinators if there was enough employer or employee demand. And in fact, there was an interesting story of a community vaccinator who actually would find out what insurance they had, and if they didn't have a contract with them, said, if you go and you call your insurance company and tell them that you want us to contract with them, then that will get them to do this, and then you won't have to pay out of pocket next time you come in and get a flu vaccine. So that was more of a grassroots campaign. On the flip side, basically health plans said that if large employers came to them and said, I really think that you need to improve access to my population, the health plan said that they would go ahead and do that because they wanted to keep those employers. From the community vaccinator perspective, roster billing obviously simplified paperwork greatly, similar to the model that Medicare has, although there have been some other large insurers that have adopted this specifically around the H1N1 vaccine last year. And then actually others cited that there were third-party billing firms that could minimize the need for billing infrastructure. So an interesting example that I had not realized before this were these pharmacy-based management firms. So pharmacies can farm out the billing aspects to these PBMs, and it turns out there's only less than a dozen PBMs in the entire country, and those PBMs generally have contracts with all of the major health insurers. So that was a way to have somebody else deal with the billing and contracting and for them to provide the services. And then finally, we learned as this project evolved that there were training programs that were beginning to be put in place to teach public health, both local and state public health, how to contract and bill health plans directly. We also found some innovative alternatives to billing. So in one instance, there were coupons. So health plans actually gave their members coupons who were eligible according to their health plan to take to community vaccinators, such as retail-based clinics or pharmacies, to receive flu vaccines free of charge. All they had to do was give the community vaccinator their coupon, and the community vaccinator didn't need a contract at all with the health plan. They could essentially turn in the coupon for payment. Of course, employee clinics were well established, where the employer pays the community vaccinator directly, and that could occur at the workplace setting or at prearranged community clinics. So sometimes the employer said, I'll pay for you to go down the street to this retail-based clinic or this pharmacy. If you'll just go ahead and get your vaccine, it'll be covered as long as you say you work for me. And then finally, again, what was brought up was this partnership between providers who could bill insurers, so for example, the primary care providers, and the medical services firms, so that the medical services firms wouldn't have to set up the 400 bazillion contracts with all the health plans and also figure out point of service eligibility. Rather, they just partner with somebody who already had that in place. The limitations of our study were that these qualitative interviews were useful for characterizing barriers and identifying potential solutions. However, the impact on each barrier on vaccination outcomes was not evaluated in the study. And generalizability may be limited, though we purposively sampled stakeholder groups of varying size and geographic region. So in conclusion, we did find barriers to influenza vaccine delivery in community settings that occurred at three major stages of purchase and distribution, delivery, and reimbursement. But the one sort of common theme across the board was that collaborations within and across stakeholder groups were key facilitators to the expansion of vaccine delivery in community settings at all stages. And I'd just like to thank my collaborators and the many people who actually helped us identify some of these stakeholders for interview. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace. And we actually have a few minutes for maybe two or three questions. If you have any questions, please step to the microphone in the center of the room.
Hi, Ray Strickus, Immunization Services Division, CDC. I had a question for Ms. McGinty and one for the folks from Tennessee. I'm not sure that in your comparison of pods and school-located vaccination, you were comparing like with like. Can you comment on whether the cost of vaccinating children was any different between the two, or was it comparable to the numbers you presented? Because you mixed adults and kids when you presented the pods data, but the school-located, I assume, was all kids. And more to the point is the cost of giving two doses in a pod comparable to the cost of giving two doses in a school? So I'm just trying to hone in on something that's a little easier to compare.
Do you want to answer? So we only vaccinated children in schools, and we didn't distinguish between who the recipient was. So we didn't assume that the cost for vaccinating a child was different than the cost for vaccinating an adult. So the pod costs were cost per vaccine administered. It didn't look at whether it was a child or an adult.
But is the cost of calling a kid back for a second dose incorporated in this? Because that's
no. It's a per dose cost. So in our total number of vaccines administered, there are second doses in that count, but the cost is just a per-dose count.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then for the folks in Tennessee, you raised the intriguing idea that some of us have kicked around, if you could combine influenza vaccination with delivering other vaccines. And the thing we've kicked around is saying, well, okay, flu vaccine ideally becomes available late July or August, back-to-school vaccination clinics, all the kids get flu vaccine, and those who need other stuff can get it there too, be it Tdap, meningitis, whatever it happens to be, depending on the age of the kids. Is that something that you're considering?
Yes. One of the things that we've talked about with our school systems is that we would like to get into the schools during the fall season and combine the influenza clinic with trying to really, I say, the teenage vaccinations. And they are open to that. This season, with the introduction of TIV, we did open that door. Previously to that, our public school system did not want to do shots inside their school system. But this year, with that introduction, we've opened the door, and part of our initial discussions was that we would move towards trying to do some of these other things.
Thank you.
Hi, Jane Zucker from the New York City Health Department. My question is for Tennessee. Obviously, we're looking for sustainable ways that we can run our school-located vaccination program. And so I was very intrigued by the model you presented. But no costs were presented, actually. You talked about grants that were available and different funding. But how much did it actually cost you? Because that's what we need. How much money is it going to cost us to actually start, you know, one of the programs to make it sustainable? This fee of sort of administration cost of $7 per dose, I can't make the math work. So you're talking about 30,000 kids, and that's $210,000. And I don't think you can run a program on that amount of money. So in terms of paying nursing costs, and really, we're talking about paper, consent, everything it's going to cost for a program. So can you please speak to what it actually what is VaxCare actually paying for, you know, to be involved in that program, and
sure.
How much in grant dollars, staffing costs did it cost the Knox County Health Department for the program?
Sure. Well, New York City, we just charge you $100 per kid. We go. So we do fine. $100 million, we'll do it. Now, the true cost of that is our cost. And so you look at any program, and we don't get into the nitty-gritty because that's a question I knew would be raised. You look at a program holistically. You have to have VFC doses for part of those kids, the kids that are going to be VFC eligible, and you have to have private stock available for those kids who will be private stock eligible. The cost per administration is the cost per administration. We can do things at a scale that other partners can't. And we're not the only company in the world that can do that. We're the one that Knox County chose. And we think, of course, you know, we're biased. We think we do it better than anybody else as well. But that includes VIS forms, consent forms, supplies. When you're talking about TIV, you got needles, band-aids, alcohol swabs, Spanish and English consent forms. When you're using Flumis, we got, you know, gloves and we got Kleenex. I mean, all costs are $7 per administration. What we're trying to paint a picture is, what's your worst case scenario? Let's say not one kid gets billed. Not one kid. Not one kid gets billed. We got a cost of vaccine for the private stock. You got VFC stock, which does cost money but doesn't cost anybody any money. And you've got a cost per administration of $7 per child. That's the worst case scenario. This year, in the transition year, we did bill. We billed Medicaid, and we're still getting accounts receivable coming in. That number is changing day to day, and so we're actually getting those kids. This year in Tennessee, we only billed that 20 or 30% Medicaid. We did not bill private pay kids. This year, we'll be billing, you know, 30 payers potentially in Tennessee, billing those plus Medicaid. And the only people we'll have a shortfall on will be that 30%.
And just to address the question a little bit further, during the first 5 years of the program, we gave an $11 administration fee, basically as our average, and that did include us buying vaccine, being able to use VFC 317, as well as you know, providing the nursing staff, going out into the schools, setting up the program. And you know, initially, those first couple of years when we went into the schools, we spent a lot of time developing relational capital with the schools and the principals. One of the biggest things is co-opting the principal into believing that this is a very doable thing, as well as it's going to benefit them. They are a make or break when you look at developing a school-located program. You can talk to your superintendent, but the make or break is the principal. So for us, if you look at our cost averaged out over 5 years, it was right at that $11 range. Now, granted, we've been very blessed in that we have received a couple of grants that's helped us defray those costs. So,
I would just add to that. I mean, we mentioned this the other day. I think one of the reps here was in the room. If an entity has a certain amount of money, you have what you have. Let's say if, you know, another H1N1 happens and somebody has $1 million to run a program. You can run $1 million program and do X number of doses at a certain cost of $11, or you can do more doses if it's cheaper per child. So all we're trying to prove is that we can give the most number of immunizations possible with a set amount of money, whether that comes from the federal government, whether it comes from billing, whether it comes from resources from the school, you know, school funds that get added, or the health department ponies up their own budget. The point is, can we do it more cheaply and more efficiently?
Maybe afterwards I'll just go through the math, because it's
absolutely
still not sort of adding up.
Absolutely.